It is really good to be here tonight. I was traveling over last weekend. I got a chance to go up to Cape Cod, where they had the Cape Cod Symposium on Addictive Disorders. A lot of the top addiction treatment specialist people show up at this and rub elbows, and then there's all these different courses that you can take to get CEUs if you're a professional. A lot of different presentations. And more, the reason I'm bringing this up, more and more, a lot of the presentations revolve around the lessons that have been learned in Alcoholics Anonymous. In other words, these psychiatrists and these psychologists have topics called of bottles, booze, and big books would be like one presentation. Another would be the efficacy of the 12 steps in addiction treatment. And another one would be, you know, what us doctors should know about the big book that works. And, you know, there are topic after topic that these top high-level addictionologists are presenting at this Cape Cod Symposium on Addictive Disorders. And a couple of the presentations this year were very interesting, because what they were doing was they were looking at the actual step process and how it affects the brain, how it affects the areas of the brain that relate to addictive illness. And that, you know, I'll just give you one example. Now, I'm not a big proponent of 90 and 90 because I don't find it in the big book, but it's not a bad thing to do. I just don't like people saying you have to do it, because then they put unreasonable expectations sometimes on an individual who may not be able to make 90 meetings in 90 days. But irregardless of that, you know, my opinion on that, they're seeing that after 90 days of doing something specifically, it basically turns into a habit. So a lot of the suggestions, a lot of the processes in Alcoholics Anonymous that have been around for 75 years, these scientists are defining now with the most modern of scientific theory and application. So what they're discovering is things that we've known for a whole lot of years, and that is that this step process works for addiction. It's observable. It's now becoming measurable as science moves forward, and more of these professionals are tending to embrace this spirituality that's very, very difficult to quantify or qualify. So I just thought I would throw that out there, because this stuff that we talk about here every week, this stuff works. This is important material, and more and more people are finding it efficacious, would be the term that the professionals use. Efficacious meaning it's very effective. Now, I'm gonna read from a couple of places in the 12 and 12, which I normally don't do, but there's two short statements in here that I think are very, very apropos for what's happening here on Tuesday nights every week. AA's 12 steps are a group of principles, spiritual in their nature, which, if practiced as a way of life, can expel the obsession to drink and enable the sufferer to become happily and usefully whole. Now, talk about promises. Talk about a statement of hope. They're saying that these principles that are spiritual in their nature, these 12 steps, if we try to practice them as a way of life, as our operational methodology, they can expel the obsession to drink. You will be safe and protected against alcohol. The alcohol problem will be removed while you are in the midst of practicing these principles as a way of life. And that's really what we're looking for when we come into AA. But on top of that, it's going to enable us to become happily and usefully whole. Things that we really want in our lives. I mean, who doesn't want to be happy? And who doesn't want to be whole and useful? Every one of us does. But But the more we drink, the further we become, the further we move away from there. The more we come, the more we practice these spiritual principles of the 12 steps, the more we head in the right direction, and we start to really see what life is all about. Now, there's a great warning in why it's buried in Tradition 9. I have no idea. But this is on page 174, and it's in the 12 and 12, and it's in Tradition 9. And I'm gonna read this. This is one of the most powerful statements I think Bill Wilson has ever written in his life. Unless each AA member follows to the best of his ability our suggested 12 steps to recovery, he almost certainly signs his own death warrant. His drunkenness and disillusion are not penalties inflicted by people in authority. They result from his personal disobedience to spiritual principles. All right. If you have relapsed, you're going to have an idea of why you relapsed. You're going to have a reason, you're going to have an excuse, you're going to have an explanation. But basically, the only reason that is really valid for a relapse, once you've come into Alcoholics Anonymous and you've seen the steps up on the wall, the only reason that's of any value is you disobey spiritual principles. That's why you relapse in Alcoholics Anonymous. You don't fully embrace this program. You know, some people cannot or will not give themselves to this simple program. That's how you relapse, by not giving yourself to this simple program. Now, the dangerous thing today in Alcoholics Anonymous is many groups have moved away from the teaching and the practice of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they've become more like the group therapy that you see in treatment centers. You know, the discussion meetings can resemble a whole lot the group therapy that you see in treatment centers. And I'm not criticizing discussion meetings. I think discussion meetings are very appropriate. But what happened, at least up in the Northeast, is probably 9 out of 10 meetings in the Northeast are discussion meetings. And more often than not, when you don't have a literature base to a meeting, it can go way to left field. Has anybody in here been in a meeting where if you walked in the middle of it, you wouldn't have even recognized it as an AA meeting? Okay? Let the record show all 400 people here tonight raise their hand. This is being recorded. Has anybody in here ever said, "Oh my God, you know, will they please shut up? Please tell somebody who cares about that stuff," you know? The same hands went up, folks. Okay, now again, discussion meetings are valid and appropriate. I'm a fan, though, of literature-based meetings because it's easier to bring them back on topic if you're using literature as a basis for a meeting, for topics in a meeting. I think the craziest thing we do in a meeting filled with people who haven't gone through the steps is ask, "Hey, does anybody have a problem?" Well, yes, everybody's got a problem. If you haven't gotten through the steps, you've got big problems. It doesn't help to talk about them. It helps to talk about the solution to them, you know. Or does anybody have a topic? Yeah, my Aunt Fanny did something or other, you know. I mean, this is shit. These meetings are appropriate. They can be like beginner's meetings where people are learning how to share and learning like what's appropriate in Alcoholics Anonymous. But to have 9 of your meetings, discussion meetings out of 10, that's really pushing it. And, you know, I think that you can go so far to the left field that you can forget that the 12 steps are a group of principles, spiritual in their nature, if when practiced as a way of life, can expel the obsession to drink and enable us to become happily and usefully whole. And sometimes we forget that unless an AA member practices to the best of their ability these suggested 12 steps, they almost certainly sign their death warrant. You know, so we need to remember this as Alcoholics Anonymous members in good standing. We need to remember this. Well, the steps don't take long to go through. And then you can enjoy yourself in the fellowship. You can do service work. You know, you can attend meetings. It really doesn't take all that much time to get through the steps. But if we forget the steps, what we're going to do is we're going to ensure that whoever we're working with or whoever is in our meetings is going to relapse or is just going to walk out of AA. There's just not going to be enough in there for them. Now, last week we started to talk about step 9. We got a little bit of a start into step 9 on page 77 for anybody that wants to follow along. We were talking about how to approach the man we hate. You know, this was a big surprise to me that I was going to have to go back to these horses patoots who I just hated. You know, I was walking around with hatred for probably about 20 or 30 different people. It was a surprise to me to find out that you actually, most times, sometimes it's inappropriate, but for most of the time, you are going to need to make direct amends to the people that you are really pissed off at. Why? Because resentment is the number one killer. It kills more alcoholics than alcohol does. That's why. It corrodes your spiritual condition. It sucks the life out of your quality of life. And it's a relapse waiting to happen if you hang on to these resentments. So the best possible way to handle a resentment that just won't go away is to find out what your part is in this resentment. Now, I had a spiritual mentor for a long time. He's since passed, but he used to say, Even if it's only 5% of the problem is yours, you need to take 100% responsibility for that 5%. So if somebody is 20 times more at fault than you are, when you look at it on paper, you need to take responsibility for your 5%, your 1 out of 20. Why do we have to do this? To be free of that emotional bondage to resentment. It ruins our quality of life. The question you have to ask is, maybe you're right, it's really their fault, maybe you're right. Well, would you rather be right or would you rather survive? Would you rather be right or would you rather be happy? You know, these are questions that we need to ask ourselves because we're so stubborn. We want to hold on to this, you know. Another guy I knew, you know, had a resentment against his neighbor. He just hated this guy for 20 years. He finally went out and made amends to the guy, and they ended up becoming best friends. You know, so often our perspective, our perception on life is just wrong. We're seeing things the wrong way. We're perceiving that we're under attack, you know, from the universe or from specific people. And when in reality, they're not doing it to us. They're just doing it. And we're in the way. And we're taking it personal. And we're suffering for it because we're taking it personal. You know, and when we start to see these things in step 4, we start to see that there might be a way out of this. How about not having a problem with anybody on this planet? How about that? What would that feel like? What kind of freedom would that be? To just not have any hate in your heart. And I think it's necessary for the alcoholic to at least try to get to that point. Because resentments are the number one offender. They kill more alcoholics than anything else. And if you find somebody that disobeys spiritual principles, like it said in the 12 and 12, it's usually somebody that has resentments, unresolved resentments. They're not willing to let go of them. And that's disobedience to these spiritual principles, not hanging on to those resentments. Now, we've looked at how do we approach the man we hate, and we talked a little bit about that. I'm going to pick it up at the bottom paragraph on 77. It talked about we take the bit in our teeth and we just go to the person and we go to him in a helpful and forgiving spirit, confessing our former ill feeling and expressing our regret. Right, this is basically what they're telling us to do with the man we hate. Under no condition do we criticize such a person or argue. Simply, we tell him that we will never get over our drinking until we have done our utmost to straighten out the past. We are there to sweep off our side of the street, realizing that nothing worthwhile can be accomplished until we do so. Never trying to tell him what he should do. Let's look at this. If we don't sweep off our side of the street, if we don't take 100% responsibility for our part, nothing worthwhile can be accomplished. You think they mean that? Do you think they mean if we don't do our amends, nothing worthwhile in Alcoholics Anonymous can be accomplished? What if that's true? His faults are not discussed. We stick to our own. If our manner is calm, frank, and open, we will be gratified with the results. In 9 cases out of 10, the unexpected happens. This has been my experience. If you're anything like me and you're facing some tough amends, especially the man you hate, you know, you're thinking this is going to go bad. You know, I'm going to feel small. I'm going to look stupid. I might end, you know, he's going to call the cops. You know, I mean, what I do is I predict dire consequences of this particular amends. And 9 out of 10 cases, I get a generous response. It goes way better than I could have imagined. And I think it's the alcoholic personality. Because today, if I'm playing, you know, I had to do an amends the other day. And the other day, I was thinking to myself, well, you know, the last 372 times I've done this, it's gone great. But this time, I know it's going to be bad. You know, it's like that's just the way the alcoholic thinks. That's why he says we take the bit in our teeth. Don't worry about what the consequences are going to be. Don't worry about what the outcome is. That's none of your business. What's your business is taking the action, doing the amends. I think God's in charge of the results. You know, we're so results-oriented. We've come from a very controlling place. And we want to know everything before we do anything. And sometimes these spiritual exercises are just that. They're spiritual exercises. We need to do this with faith. We need to do this with faith and with courage. Sometimes the man we are calling upon admits his own fault. That's almost always happened. So feuds of years standing will melt away in an hour. Rarely do we fail to make satisfactory progress. Our former enemies sometimes praise what we are doing and wish us well. I can't tell you how many stories I've heard about people going back to former employers and that leading to some amazing financial thing, whether it's a job or a contract or whatever. You know, you think going back to your employer and admitting that you were embezzling from the slush fund or something, you figure you're going to go to jail. But usually what happens is the person is so impressed that you're being honest that, you know, they remember you, you know, and down the road you get a phone call because somebody that's that honest is trustworthy and I want him in my new endeavor, you know. And I can't tell you how many times that's happened. Occasionally they will offer assistance. It should not matter, however, if someone does throw us out of his office. We have made our demonstration, done our part, it's water over the dam. I've been thrown out of the office. Like I say, 9 times out of 10, it's a generous response. Every once in a while, it's not gonna be. Okay? Somebody is still gonna be pissed off at you. And that's okay too. I had a boss. He was literally my boss in my last 2 years of drinking. You know, what he saw. I remember this one time. It's a Christmas party, okay? And he's got all his clients there, and we're in the shop. And he was a beer drinker, but every once in a while, if it was Christmas or something, he'd put out some hard liquor. And he came up to me and he said, "Chris, now you promised me you're just going to drink a few beers. You stay away from the hard stuff." "Sure, Frank, yeah. So what happened is he's playing craps. There's a crap table. Everybody's having fun, Christmas trees. And I see a bottle of whiskey, and I just grab it. And I do one of these, I drink about half of this quart of whiskey, and now I'm hammered. I went from a little bit buzzed on a couple of beers to hammered. And I go outside, and this is, I was an electrical contractor at the time, and go outside, and there was this big, huge post light that was sitting there. It was was for their job the next day. And then there were cases of beer, like about 10 feet high. And I go out, and I'm really drunk, and I lean up against this light post, and it's not bolted to the ground or anything. So I lean against it, and I fall with the light post, and the cases of beer come down on me. And I'm literally underneath these cases of beer. You can see a couple of hands and a couple of legs, like, struggling. Then my boss is like, God damn it! You know, and he comes in, like, yelling at me. I mean, it's just time after time after time, I'm doing stupid things with this guy. Blowing things up. You know what I mean? You know, just causing him all kinds of trouble. Oh, man. So, I've got to make amends to this guy. So, I stop over his shop. You know, throws me out. About two or three months later, same thing. Stop over the shop. What are you doing here? Throws me out again. So, all right. About 6 months later, I'm figuring this water over the dam. You know, I made my demonstration. I tried to go see this guy. I tried to make amends. But what happened was I caught him at the barbershop. I walk in, I'm going to get my hair cut, and there he is over in the corner. He's going to get his hair cut, too. So I got him trapped. So I go over and I sit down with him, and, you know, I make amends. You know, I say, Frank, you know, here's what I need to talk to you about. You know, I made direct amends to him. I told him what was going on with me, you know, how out of control I was. I gave him the whole spiel. And he was cool about it. About a year later, you know, I'm doing really large scale project management and facilities work, and I needed an electrician. I called him up, and we're doing contracts together. You know, I mean, and this was the guy that threw me out of the office. These things are very, very powerful when you do these. You have no idea what the outcome can be. You have no idea what the chain of circumstances of your amends is going to cause in the future for the healing of the world. So often, when you make direct amends and you basically say what it says to do in here, you know, I'll never get over drinking unless I try to set right the wrongs and, you know, set everything, you know, try to, you know, make up for the things I've done in the past. People remember that. And you're going to get a call. You're going to get a call from some of these people saying, you know, my son is in trouble, or, you know, I've got a neighbor, or listen, I've been drinking too much. Can I talk to you about it? What we do is we become part of the healing instead of part of the problem when we start moving into this step. And again, remember, failure to adhere to some of these spiritual principles is how we get drunk. You know, we don't get drunk because we change our mind. So often we'll come back in to AA after being in AA for 5 years and you get drunk. You know, you raise your hand, well, you know, I decided the other night to go out to the bar. No, you didn't decide to go out to the bar. Nobody goes to AA for 5 years and then decides to get drunk. That's completely insane. What happened was you failed to adhere to spiritual principles, and you lost the power that was keeping you separated from booze. You weren't there. Your ego wants you to think you were there buying that drink. You weren't there. You weren't there because you were powerless. Your ego wants to think you changed your mind. Yeah, well, you know, I was in AA for about 5 years, and life was really going good. I was back in the big bed, you know, and I was getting myself out of debt, and I decided I would just drive down to the bar and, you know, just blow my whole entire paycheck and, you know, wake up upside down with vomit in my hair, you know, not knowing what state I was in, you know, because I just kind of decided to do that. You know, no, we don't do that. We're powerless if we're not practicing these principles. These principles offer us power. They call it the power of God. When we practice these principles, this power works through us and can keep us safe and protected. If we think we're doing this stuff, we're going to be in trouble. You know, I don't know about all this step stuff and all this other stuff and everything. I just don't drink. No, you just don't get it. All right? You're either not an alcoholic or you're a drunk waiting to happen, if that's what you're doing, you know? Because every bit of the Alcoholics Anonymous literature stands against that kind of a theory, that you just don't drink. Occasionally they will offer assistance. If someone does throw us out of his office, we've made our demonstration, done our part, it's water over the dam. All right, let's look at money we owe, okay? This is kind of tricky because I don't know too many alcoholics that come into AA that don't owe money. We owe little bits of money all over the place. Usually we didn't have it together enough to like owe a lot. But one of the guys that I worked with, here's his story. This guy was beautiful. He was stoned and drunk every day of his life. He was a philosophy major, and during the boom years of the late 80s and early 90s on Wall Street, he became a stock analyst. How did he become a stock analyst? Just because this guy was leaving the company and wanted to really screw the company, so he put this like hippie pot smoking stock analyst in. He hired him, and all of a sudden this guy's in. Now he used to just figure out, you know, which companies this firm should invest in, and he started to hit. I mean, he started to really do well. He became the top analyst in this company. Every single company he picked made a fortune for these people. He was picking a lot of Canadian companies that were making auto parts for our auto industry, and they were, everything was going really well. He had limousines picking him up in Basking Ridge, like about an hour outside the city, and bringing him to work every day so he could smoke pot on the way in. Now, what happened was he got a resentment because his bonus wasn't big enough. He was getting $400,000 a year bonuses, this guy. Okay, can you imagine? He's stoned out of his mind. And, you know, this Wall Street just doesn't do things like this anymore. It really doesn't. But for a while, there was just wheelbarrows of cash just going back and forth everywhere. And, you know, you didn't even have to be smart to grab yourself one. Anyway, what happened was he got a resentment, you know, they didn't put his name on the bathroom door or something. And so he leaves, and he's going to bring a bunch of investors with him. So he talks to all these people that were investing in his firm. He goes, you know, I'm the guy that picked all the good stuff. I'm going to start my own firm. So he starts his own firm, his own investment company, and he signs a personal note to every single one of the investors. Now, what that means is if there's a loss instead of a gain, he personally guarantees to cover it. So he's still really stoned. He's out there. He's going crazy. He's like saying, let's, you know, give me, everybody's giving him millions of dollars. These people are giving this guy millions of dollars because he was really on for a while. But now he starts to tank. Now every single thing he picks is a dog, and it starts to lose money. And he throws a ton of money into a couple of companies that go bankrupt, which means these investors that put like $4 million into stock of company A that goes bankrupt loses that $4 million. And this guy signed it personally. So when he came in and he started to work the steps with me, and we got to the step, he started laughing. He goes, I'm on unemployment now. I owe like $7 million. How am I supposed to pay these people back? And I said, well, let's just see what this says. Most alcoholics owe money. We do not dodge our creditors. Telling them what we are trying to do, we make no bones about our drinking. They usually know it anyhow, whether we think so or not. Nor are we afraid of disclosing our alcoholism on the theory that it may cause financial harm. So many people misunderstand anonymity. They think anonymity means secrecy. They think that as soon as you get sober, you've got to go underground and not tell anybody, you know, that you're an alcoholic. You know, where does Dad go every night? Oh, he goes to the Rotary Club. You know, I had a sponsee. I had a sponsee whose father was 20 years sober, and he didn't know his father was in AA. I mean, that's how stupid this guy was. I mean, you know,
anonymity, anonymity, anonymous, it's anonymous. Everything's anonymous.
No, it's not anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous is anonymous at the level of press, radio, TV, and film. How many times are we on TV? Okay? Now, you can personally take anonymity as far as you want, but you don't have to. Okay? We can tell people we're alcoholic when we're making amends. As a matter of fact, it might even be helpful. It might not, but it might be helpful. We have to use good judgment, tact, and common sense. Approached this way, the most ruthless creditor will sometimes surprise us. Arranging the best deal we can, we let these people know that we are sorry. That's what this guy did. He went back to these people and he said, you know, I know I owe you $4 million. I'm taking responsibility for it. I can give you $10 a week. you know, get the hell out of here. Most of them threw him out. But he stayed sober. You know what I mean? He stayed sober. If he would just, like, hide the rest of his life, he probably wouldn't have been able to stay sober. Our drinking has made us slow to pay. We must lose our fear of creditors, no matter how far we have to go, for we are liable to drink if we're afraid to face them. Here's another guy that I worked with for a while. I worked with him for 10 years, until finally, you know, he had to go. And he's been through every sponsor on the East Coast, this guy. You ever know those people that jump from sponsor to sponsor? As soon as it gets a little bit hot, you know, things are getting hot, he wants me to actually do something, I think I'll get another sponsor. Now, this individual was a painter, and from 1972 on, he never paid income tax. Everything was a cash maneuver. Everything. No income tax. Well, he starts going through the steps with me, and I say, well, you know, you're going to have to deal with this. And it's better to go to the IRS and say, okay, here's what I did. Let's look at what we can do here. It's better to do that than let them catch you. So he was unwilling to do that. He looked at how monstrous the number would be. He probably owed $500,000, $600,000, $700,000, $800,000, and if they put interest on that, you know, forget it. So he wouldn't do it. He wouldn't do it, and has not done it. This individual hasn't seen 90 days, and he's been trying for 20 years. Okay? We get drunk because we fail to adhere to spiritual principles. Making an amends and trying to set this right, making the best deal you can at any given time, is a spiritual principle. All right, criminal offenses. How many people in here have done criminal offenses? Do some crimes, and the rest of you lying good for nothing. Okay. Perhaps we have committed a criminal offense, which might land us in jail if it were known to the authorities. Oh my God. It might land us in jail if it was known to the authorities. We may be short in our accounts and unable to make good. We have already admitted this in confidence to another person, but we are sure we would be imprisoned or lose our job if it were known. Maybe it's only a petty offense such as padding the expense account. Most of us have done that sort of thing. Maybe we are divorced and have remarried but haven't kept up the alimony to number one. She's indignant about it and has a warrant out for our arrest. That's a common form of trouble too. Any alcoholics in here get divorced? Any people that have gone through a divorce? That's pretty good. Up north, it's a much higher percentage. The more heathen up there. Although these reparations take innumerable forms, there are some general principles which we find guiding. Reminding ourselves that we have decided to go to any lengths to find a spiritual experience. Remember, that was part of step three, making a decision to go to any lengths. So if you're working through the book with a sponsee and they start balking, you can say, hey, you know, you said you were willing to go to any lengths, and I showed you what any lengths looked like. I had you read this book. What are you balking for? You know? Put on your grown-up pants and get out there and start making some amends. We ask that we be given the strength and direction to do the right thing no matter what the personal consequences may be. That's a prayer directive. We ask that we be given the strength and direction to do the right thing no matter what the personal consequences may be. You know, I heard one time in a meeting, and I just couldn't believe it. This guy raises his hand, and he goes, you know, I got to step 9, and I was talking to my sponsor about it, and my sponsor said, you know, if it harms others, and I'm an other, you know, I don't need to do this event. One thing I am absolutely sure of in Alcoholics Anonymous, folks, is that we ain't others. You know what I mean? If it hurts us too bad, we have to be willing to do this, or we may drink again. And for us to drink is to die. Sometimes the hairiest amends out there is like kissing a baby's butt compared to putting alcohol back in our body. You know what I mean? Do the amends, drink a quart of whiskey. I mean, what's easier? I don't know about you, but I don't want to go back. I don't want to go back to that whiskey and that vodka. That took me to places I never want to revisit. It says here we may lose our position or reputation or face jail, but we are willing. We have to be. We must not shrink in anything. Now, I've seen heroic amends done. You know, I always insist the people that I'm working with do every single one that they absolutely can do. I don't care. I don't want to hear it, you know, unless it really is going to cause somebody else harm or there's no possible way to do it. They're getting on a plane. They're getting on a boat. They're getting a taxi. They're taking a rickshaw. Whatever they need to do to go face these people, they're going to do it. But I've only seen a handful of times people go to prison after they made amends. Now, one of them was this guy. He's a friend of mine from California. He was in New Jersey for a while, and he was going through the steps. And he came to me and another guy, and he said, look, I got some outstandings in Colorado. I got multiple warrants in Colorado, and they're not good. And we're like, okay, well, what do you want to do about it? And he goes, well, I don't want to be looking over my shoulder the rest of my life. I don't want to be the type of person who has to stay underground all the time. And I'm worried about putting my Social Security number on something. I can't do that. So I'm going to go do the amends. And so we had him talk to a lawyer. The lawyer said, yeah, you're probably going to do some time. And he went. And he turned himself in. That's a good thing. If they catch you, that's a bad thing. He went and he turned himself in. He did about 8 months, you know, for like 5 or 6, you know, felony warrants. He did about 8 months, got the hell out of Colorado, and now he's surfing in Hawaii with you know, a brand new wife, and he's living it up. He's just living it up. He's an AA member in good standing. You know what I mean? And it's behind him now. You know, so a lot of us are going to have these things. I went back and made direct amends to about a half a dozen places where I caused where I did crimes that harmed them. And every single time it was a positive thing. It wasn't like I'm calling the police. A lot of times it was like 30 years ago, you know what I mean? But I think that we need to do this. How free do you want to be is what you need to keep asking yourself. How free do you want to be? Usually, however, other people are involved. Therefore, we do not be the hasty and foolish martyr who would needlessly sacrifice others to save himself from the alcoholic pit. A man we know had remarried. Because of resentment and drinking, he had not paid alimony to his first wife. She was furious. She went to court and got an order for his arrest. He had commenced our way of life, had secured a position, and was getting his head above water. It would have been impressive heroics if he had walked up to the judge and said, "Here I am." We thought he ought to be willing to do that if necessary, but if he were in jail, he could provide nothing for either family. We suggested he write his first wife, admitting his faults and asking forgiveness. He did, and also sent a small amount of money. He told her that he would try what he would try to do in the future. He said he was perfectly willing to go to jail if she insisted. Of course, she did not, and the whole situation has since been adjusted. When other people are involved, there are amends when other people are involved. Amends are not to be done hastily. What I always recommend is I recommend that you get spiritual counsel with someone with experience. If your sponsor hasn't done amends, if your sponsor's like the majority of people in AA who have made cursory amends to their family and let the whole rest of the world, you know, go, that's not the person you want to be going through this part of the steps with. You're going to want to go through the steps with someone who has some experience. And a lot of times, those people with experience, if they don't have specific experience, they will point you to somebody that does. In other words, I have never had to make amends to the IRS. If somebody comes to me and there's an IRS amends, I will point them to one of my friends who's done so, or I will point them to an attorney that handles IRS claims. Because I don't know everything, you know. But if I have experience, I will share it with an individual. You do not want somebody editing your spiritual program. You do not want somebody that'll say, you know, I don't really think you need to go out and, you know, that's a whole big to-do. I don't know that you really need to do that. You don't want to be going through the steps with somebody like that. They're shortchanging you. They're giving you their own experience. They've never done it, so that's what they're thinking that you don't need to either. But the fact of the matter is you may have to. You may be a real alcoholic, and you may get drunk if you don't do this. So anyway, I'll tell you a story about when others were involved. I'm not sure if I shared here or somewhere else, the time that I trashed the house down in Florida. Well, what happened was there were two other roommates that were involved with this, and you know, one of them was dead from cirrhosis of the liver. You know, big surprise. He was living with me. The other individual was still around. He was a heavy drinker. He was somebody who drank for drink with me, but when the time came that, you know, advice from a doctor, you know, a new relationship, he basically stopped and moderated the rest of his life. He was involved with this, and I told him, look, I've got to track these people down, and I've got to make direct amends, you know, but I need to talk to you first. He goes, hey, knock yourself out. Just don't tell them where I live, you know. So, all right, so... You know, when somebody else is involved, you know, if it's a felony, like a breaking and entering felony, you know, and you know, there's accomplices, you have people with you, you got to be careful. You can't implicate anybody else. That's not what we're about. We're not about causing harm to anybody else. We're about taking responsibility for the harm we've caused. Before taking drastic action which might implicate other people, we secure their consent. If we have obtained permission, have consulted with others, asked God to help, and the drastic step is indicated, we must not shrink. We must take the bit in our teeth, and we must do it. This brings to mind a story about one of our friends. While drinking, he accepted a sum of money from a bitterly hated business rival, giving him no receipt for it. He subsequently denied having received the money and used the incident as a basis for discrediting the man. Now, this is awful. This is like a business competitor. And what you've done is you've borrowed a bunch of money from them, and then when they want it back, you spread all over town that this person is trying to embezzle you. But you don't really owe this person this money. So now you're making him look dishonest. So you're really ruining this person. You've got his money, and now you're ruining his business. He thus used his own wrongdoing as a means of destroying the reputation of another. In fact, his rival was ruined. That's a tough one. Listen to how he did this. He felt that he had done a wrong he could not possibly make right. If he opened that old affair, he was afraid it would destroy the reputation of his partner, disgrace his family, and take away his means of livelihood. What right had he to involve those dependent upon him? How could he possibly make a public statement exonerating his rival? After consulting with his wife and partner, he came to the conclusion that it was better to take those risks than to stand before his Creator guilty of such ruinous slander. I love how that's put. He saw that he had to place the outcome in God's hands, or he would soon start drinking again and all would be lost anyhow. Now this is somebody who gets it. He gets it. He understands he's going to be drinking if he doesn't do this amends. Some of us are not that clear. because we have not gone through this work with someone that's experienced. He attended church for the first time in many years, and after the sermon, he quietly got up and made an explanation. Remember, how he hurt this person was by spreading ruinous slander around the town. So by going to the guy and apologizing, that's not really going to cut it. So what he does is he goes to a church where a lot of the townspeople are, and he makes an explanation. He basically explains what he did to this guy and how he was wrong. His action met widespread approval, and today he is one of the most trusted citizens in his town. See, this is part of the you know, 9 out of 10 times the unexpected happens. Something like that actually made him more trusted. You know, I bet you he was scared to death walking up to that altar. This all happened years ago. The chances are, okay, here's domestic troubles. You know, we might have stepped out on the missus, you know, or, you know, we might have had that secret and exciting relationship with somebody that, you know, we really want to kind of keep quiet. Perhaps we are mixed up with women in a fashion we wouldn't care to have advertised. We doubt if this is, in this respect, alcoholics are fundamentally much worse than other people, but drinking does complicate sex relations in the home. After a few years with an alcoholic, a wife gets worn out, resentful, or uncommunicative. You know, where it says wife, you know, this is a very... It's a sexist book, you know. I'll say that. Back in the day, it was very patriarchal, and they really didn't see women as alcoholics like they saw the men as alcoholics. So, rather than get mad if you're a woman, rather than get mad at this obvious, you know, chauvinistic dialogue, just change it to, if it says wife, change it to husband. You know, personalize it. After a few years with an alcoholic, a husband gets worn out, resentful and uncommunicative. You know, it's universal. How could he be anything else? You know, do it like that. The husband begins to feel lonely, sorry for himself. He commences to look around in the nightclubs or their equivalent for something besides liquor. What could Bill possibly mean? Perhaps he is having a secret and exciting affair with the girl who understands. In fairness, we must say that she may understand. But what are we going to do about a thing like that? A man so involved often feels very remorseful at times, especially if he is married to a loyal and courageous girl who has literally gone through hell for him. Or married to a loyal and courageous man who has literally gone through hell for her. Whatever the situation, we usually have to do something about it. Now, this is, you need to be very, very careful about this. This is one of the areas where it makes very, very clear, unless it will harm other people. Now, I had a guy that I was working with, and before he would come over my house and I could go through his 8-step list, he ran off and he made direct amends to his wife about the 3 affairs he had had in the last 15 years. She freaked. The unexpected did happen. She beat the living crap out of this guy. Okay? I mean, kicked his face in. He was hospitalized on multiple occasions. As soon as he'd start to heal, she'd lump him up again. She dragged out of him the names of the women and contacted their husbands. She was a lawyer, so she started lawsuits against these women for having unprotected sex with her husband and placing her in danger. It was a mess. Okay? It was a mess. The guy, you know, this book is not saying we need to do that kind of stuff. It's saying quite the opposite. Let's look and see what it says. If we are sure our wife does not know, should we tell her? Not always, we think. You know, honey, you know those 5 babysitters that we've had in the last 2 or 3 years? I've slept with all of them. Oh boy, I feel better getting that off my chest. You know what I mean? Phew. That's not what we're supposed to do. We're not supposed to sweep off our side of the street and put all the garbage on somebody else's. If it's going to serve no purpose, if it's only going to cause harm to the other person, we got to shut up about it. It's what we're supposed to do. If she knows in a general way that we've been wild, should we tell her in detail? Undoubtedly, we should admit our fault. She may insist on knowing all the particulars. She will want to know who the woman is and where she is. We feel we ought to say to her that we have no right to involve another person. Take your lumps. You have no right to involve another person. We are sorry for what we have done. God willing, it shall not be repeated. More than that, we cannot do. We have no right to go further. Though there may be justifiable exceptions, and though we wish to lay down no rule of any sort, we have often found this the best course to take. Our design for living is not a one-way street. It is good for the wife as it is for the husband. If we can forget, so can she. It is better, however, that one does not needlessly name a person upon whom she can vent jealousy. It's like the fourth time you said that. Okay, we need to remember this is about us taking responsibility. We need to keep other people out of it. Perhaps there are some cases where the utmost frankness is demanded. No outsider can appraise such an intimate situation. It may be that both will decide that the way of good sense and loving kindness is to let bygones be bygones. Each might pray about it, having the other one's happiness uppermost in mind. You know, back in the day, the families prayed together. That was the Oxford group way. You did morning meditation with the entire family. You did evening review. You did multiple prayer sessions with the family every day. So it says that each might pray about it, husband and wife, having the other one's happiness uppermost in mind. Keep it always in sight that we are dealing with that most terrible human emotion, jealousy. Good generalship may decide that the problem be attacked on the flank rather than risk a face-to-face combat. Well, what does that mean? That means that we just need to use tact and common sense, okay? Yes, I've been wild, you know. I've disrespected the marriage, you know. I'm working toward really straightening out, you know. I'm going to be spending more time at home. I'm going to be spending more time with you. I'm not drinking anymore. God willing, things are going to get better, and let's just hang in there, you know. If we have no such complication, there's plenty we should do at home. I think when you start to bring the AA principles into your home, you are starting to recover. Anybody in here know somebody who's like an AA angel and an at-home devil? You know, you call them up, and you go, hello? Oh, hi. Going to the Serenity Club tonight? You know? Oh. One time, listen, I know what this was like from personal experience. I remember this one time, I'm going to a meeting. God damn it, I'm going to a meeting. And there's somebody, it's a 45 mile an hour zone, and somebody's doing 30. Somebody's on this motorcycle doing like 30. This idiot shouldn't even be on a motorcycle. He's way too old. He's going too slow. He's in my way. Doesn't he know that I have places I've got to be? And so I'm tailgating him. I'm 4 inches off of his back wheel. Okay? And sure enough, he pulls right into the meeting. And it's Ross, the home group member, you know. And I tailgated him for 4 miles because I needed to get to the meeting to share about Serenity. You know? When we're practicing these principles out there in the world, that's when we start to recover. Sometimes we hear an alcoholic say that the only thing he needs to do is stay sober. I love this. The only thing I need, I'm making amends to everybody because I'm staying sober. No, you're a horse's ass, is what you are. Certainly he must keep sober, for there will be no home if he doesn't, but he is yet a long way from making good to the wife and parents, for whom for years he so shockingly treated. Passing all understanding is the patience mothers and wives have had with alcoholics. Had this not been so, many of us would have no homes today and perhaps would be dead. The alcoholic is like a tornado roaring his way through the lives of others. Hearts are broken. Sweet relationships are dead. Affections have been uprooted. Selfish and inconsiderate habits have kept the home in turmoil. Does anybody Anybody relating to this? This is the way we were. And we were expecting people to judge us by our intentions. We really mean well. And meanwhile, the house is burned down for the second time. I burned my mother's house down twice while I was living there. I remember standing out the backyard watching the firemen throw all the furniture out of the second story windows that was smoldering. And I had my head up against a tree. I just couldn't believe this. I'd left my cigarette in the ashtray, you know, drinking. And the wind had blown it off the ashtray into an open drawer filled with papers. So it started the whole desk on fire. The whole second floor was involved. And I'm downstairs mixing a drink, you know. And so I'm outside. I got my head up against the tree, and this neighbor comes up. You know, a neighbor, a good neighbor. Oh, Chris, you know, this is terrible. Can I do anything to help you? I pull a 10 out of my pocket, and I said, yeah, give me a fifth of bourbon. You know, go uptown and buy me a fifth of bourbon. He was looking at me like I was out of my mind. But how am I gonna handle my house burning down without a fifth of bourbon? You know? We feel a man is unthinking when he says sobriety is enough. He's like the farmer who came up out of his cyclone cellar to find his home ruined. To his wife, he remarked, "Don't see anything the matter here, Ma. Ain't grand the wind stopped blowing. Don't see anything the matter here, Ma. Ain't grand I'm not drinking anymore." No, you're more of a jerk now, you know, than you were when you were drinking. At least you were passed out by 9 o'clock. I gotta like look at you awake now until midnight. No, it's not better. You know, we need to go through these steps for things to get better. There's nothing worse than a dry alcoholic staring across the dinner table at you. You know, divorce is much higher once we get sober than when we were drinking. Look at the statistics. Once people get into AA, in the first 2 years, there's like a 50% chance you're going to get divorced. That's because we're not doing our job in Alcoholics Anonymous. We're you know, ain't it great the wind stop blowing? And, you know, oh, we're getting divorced. So we go to the closed-minded discussion meeting and talk about our divorce for 3 years. Every day we update everybody on every minutia of the goddamn divorce. You know what I mean? When if you would have done the steps, you wouldn't be getting divorced, you know? But I don't judge. Yes, there is a long period of reconstruction ahead. We must take the lead. A remorseful mumbling that we are sorry won't fill the bill at all. We ought to sit down with the family and frankly analyze the past as we now see it, being very careful not to criticize them. Their defects may be glaring, but the chances are that our own actions are partly responsible. Alcoholism is a family illness. We're alcoholics. The rest of the family is sick because of the manifestation of our alcoholism. You know, they're stuttering, and you know, there's all kinds of stuff that happens when you grow up a child of an alcoholic. So we clean house with the family each morning in meditation that our Creator show us the way of patience, tolerance, kindliness, and love. This is one of our meditations. The spiritual life is not a theory. We have to live it. Unless one's family expresses a desire to live upon spiritual principles, we think we ought not to urge them. This is back in the day when everybody went through the steps. All family went through the steps. We should not talk incessantly to them about spiritual matters. They will change in time. Our behavior will convince them more than our words. You know, what you're doing shouts so loudly I can't hear your words. When we're walking the walk. We must remember that 10 or 20 years of drunkenness would make a skeptic out of anyone. There may be some wrongs we can never fully right. We don't worry about them if we can honestly say to ourselves that we would right them if we could. Some people cannot be seen. We send them an honest letter. I do letters with the deceased. You know, I do graveside amends. And there may be a valid reason for postponement in some cases, but we don't delay if it can be avoided. We should be sensible, tactful, considerate, and humble. Without being servile or scraping. And we're not going to somebody so that we can be a floor mat for them. We're trying to set right or wrong. And we can do it with dignity. As God's people, we stand on our own feet. We don't crawl before anyone. How many times have you heard the promises read? The promises of AA. Okay, we've gone through a lot of material in the last like 9 weeks or so that we've been going through this book. And there's a lot of things that they've asked us to do. It says if we are painstaking about this phase of our development, we will be amazed before we're halfway through. What are they talking about there? They're talking about the amends. If we're halfway through the amends, these ninth step promises will materialize. I didn't realize that the promises were the ninth step promises for years. I thought they were the AA promises. And I was wondering why the hell they weren't happening to me. You guys are shortchanging me. I'm going to 7, 8, 9 meetings a week and I ain't seen them promises. That's because meeting attendance is not a defense against alcoholism. You know, you don't recover from alcoholism by going to meetings. You recover from it by adhering to spiritual principles. Anyway, we are going to pick this up next week on the ninth step promises. I want to thank everybody for being here. It's been a lot of fun. Thank you.